Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. See if I can find it. So we're reading in Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 66, Text 39 and 40. I guess 40 is the one that we'll chant together. I'll just read. But we'd like to do it together then? Okay. Tatsurya koti pat, everyone. Tatsurya koti patimam sudarshanam jajvalyamanam parlayanala prabham svatejasakam kakubotarodasi chakram mukundashtram atagnim ardayat. There's some nice alliteration there, huh? Especially in the second line. Translation. That Sudarshan, the disc weapon of Lord Mukunda, blazed forth like millions of suns. His effulgence blazed like the fire of universal annihilation. And with his heat, he pained the sky, all the directions, heaven and earth, and also the fiery demon. Those who have just come from Russia, we're reading about this amazing pastime where Sudakshina, who was a king, he, with the help of the priest, he unleashed a fiery demon to try to kill Krishna and burn down the city of Dwarka. And it wasn't so successful. Okay, text 40. Krityanala Patihatam Sa Ratnanga Panir Astrojasa Sa Lipa Bhagna Muko Nivritaha Varanasim Parisham Parishametya Sudakshina Tam Satvig Janam Samadahat Svakrito Abhicharaha. I think it works. Krityan ala patihata saratanga panir. Astro jasa sandipa bhagna muko nivritaha. Varanasim parishametya sudakshinam tam. Sadvig janam samadahat svakrito vicharaha. Dityan ala patihata sa ratanga panir. Astro jasa sandipa bhagna muko nivritaha. Varanasim parisametya sudakshinam tam. Sadvig janam samadahat svakrito vicharaha. Okay. Sarpi janam samatahasito vicharaham. Krityam, produced by mystic power. Analam, the fire. Pratihata, frustrated. Sahi, Rata Angapanihi, of Lord Krishna, who holds the Sudarshan disc in his hand. Astra, of the weapon. Ojasa, by the power. Sa, he. Nipa, O king. Bhagnamukha, turning away. Nivritta, having desisted. Varanashim, the city of Varanashi. Parisamityam, approaching on all sides. Sudakshinam, Sudakshinam. Tam, him. So, together with Ritvikjanam, his priests, Samadahat, burned to death. Swam, by himself. Sudakshinam. Kritam, created. Avicharaham, meant for doing violence. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. Translation, frustrated by the power of Lord Krishna's weapon. Something's wrong. Oh, I thought it was something important like that. One second. Translation, frustrated by the power of Lord Krishna's weapon, O king, the fiery creature produced by black magic turned his face away and retreated. Created for violence, the demon then returned to Varanasi, where he surrounded the city and then burned Sudakshina and his priest to death, even though Sudakshina was his creator. Purport. Srila Prabhupada comments as follows. Having failed to set fire to Dwarka, the fiery demon went back to Varanasi, the kingdom of Kashi Raj. As a result of his return, all the priests who had helped instruct the black art of mantras, along with their employer, Sudakshina, were burnt to ashes by the glaring effulgence of the fiery demon. According to the methods of black art mantras instructed in the Tantra, if the mantra fails to kill the enemy, then because it must kill someone, it kills the original creator. Sudakshina was the originator and the priest assisted him. Therefore, all of them were burned to ashes. This is the way of the demons. The demons create something to kill God, but by the same weapon, the demons themselves are killed. So the disciples of Srila Prabhupada are, they often, not the majority of the time, but from time to time, fairly frequently, when Srila Prabhupada has a comment in the Krishna book, they would either include it or use that as the whole purport, as in this case. Om Jnana Timuranda Sya Jananjana Shalakya Chakshu Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. So as I was reading the text, I realized I could have made a few very brief comments. One thing that struck me as I read the text is we may be put off a little bit by all this violence, all this killing. In this case, the Sudakshina and his priests, they get burned to death, and the whole city's going to get burnt down. And this idea of people just being killed and burned to ashes, maybe we say, well, it's not so nice. But then if we just remember that this death is not, it's like changing clothes, it's not a big deal. If we remember the Bhagavad Gita, basic philosophical perspective, we can take it with a little more equanimity. There are a few little things that I might have been able to say, but basically I don't have much to say about this. And yesterday Pushkar Prabhu, he brought out a lot of points about this pastime. I don't really have anything to add. So that's one of the reasons why I'm taking a different approach to this class, namely we'll take a few steps back and we address the issue of credibility. In other words, we'll get to that in a moment. Let me read something I wrote here. In other words, how do we respond to the highly skeptical, quote, unbeliever, who cannot conceive that such descriptions as the current Sudakshina episode are anything other than imaginary mythological narrations? And we can even frankly consider our own manner of hearing and presumably accepting the reality of these accounts. Yes, if we have been carefully studying all the previous Srimad Bhagavatam cantos up to the present section, we are supposed to be quite prepared to understand and what to speak of gaining, of being able to gain the wonderful darshan of Krishna's smiling face, the 10th canto. Nonetheless, most of us, let the truth be told, have not studied so systematically and in the recommended sequential format. In parentheses, I write, for instance, in my own case, as I travel around, I hear and speak about Canto 7, then 3, then 2, etc. And our own modern conditioning is also a factor. Perhaps it comes back to haunt us, despite our accumulation of purifying activities in sadhana and in devotional service in general. It is in this spirit that I shall now, leaning once again on the preaching of Sadaputta Prabhu, and I should mention, when I first joined, I really leaned on his great realization and intellectual prowess. Although he preached to me in a very, very simple way, you might say, but it helped me stay the course, because when I joined, the 5th canto had just been published. It was in 75. And I was like shocked. It just seemed so mythological and so hard to take seriously. And I was wondering, should I really join such a community that believes in such strange things? What to speak of Sudakshina and all what we're hearing now? So the Bhaktivedanta Institute to the rescue was just getting founded at that time. And the building next door we used to have at 70 Commonwealth Avenue in Boston, and there was Madhava and Sadaputta Prabhu, and of course Bhakti Swarup Damodar, at that time Swarup Damodar Brahmachari, and especially Madhava and Sariputta Prabhu, they would attend to my great need to be reassured that you don't have to completely abandon any and all rationality in order to accept the reality of the fifth canto and so much more, as we're hearing now. So, okay, well, let me see, what else did I say? In this spirit, I shall now, leaning once again on the preaching of Sariputta Prabhu and the Bhaktivedanta Institute, I say that because I'm almost sure that he wrote what I'm going to be reading from, but somehow in the Veda base, it doesn't give credit to his name. Maybe he wrote it in conjunction with others, but it's very much similar to his own book that we have on Vedic astronomy or Vedic cosmology. So I will venture to offer some suggestions as to how we can believe in the reality of these amazing episodes without abandoning our God-given reason. In other words, these leelas do not have to be considered, quote, unreasonable, nor swept under some, quote, mystical rug. In other words, we can just say, well, it's mystic. But what are we saying? In other words, it's kind of explaining it away rather than having some kind of rational, you know, when he says, well, why do we have to be so rational? Well, it's hard to, for some time we can separate, like we can create a dichotomy between our hearing from the Bhagavatam and our rational faculties. But sooner or later, we want these to come together. Sooner or later, we feel, sometimes it could even create a crisis if we don't connect our rational faculties with these amazing episodes that we're reading about. So let us touch on a few aspects of this topic, often referring to a work principally by Sariputta Prabhu, analyzing the Vedic paradigm from a scientific perspective. So I'll be reading from what's in the Veda base. There's a section called Science from the Vedic Viewpoint, and then within that there's a work called Vedic Cosmography and Astronomy, and that has different sections like Mystic Cities and the Vedic Conception of Space and the like. All right, so let's see if I can do this. This is quite a, we have a few minutes, so we'll just be very, we'll talk only about maybe three topics, but very briefly each one. The first is the multidimensional nature of the universe as implied by Vedic literature and also explicitly proposed by quantum physics. Rather than me try to express it, let me switch over to the Veda base and scroll up to the introductory point that Sariputta Prabhu makes in this regard. The modern Western understanding of the nature and structure of the universe as a whole is based on interpreting observed celestial phenomena within the framework of modern physics. The thesis of this book is that the framework of modern physics is too limited to accommodate many phenomena that occur within this universe. In particular, this framework cannot accommodate many features of the universe that are described in the Vedic literature. And he's not just only talking about the astronomy, he's talking about Sudakshina and how he could create a personality, how to make a fiery personality and all that. And then the Sudarshan Chakra itself, and what to speak of the status of God, of Krishna, and what he could do. In particular, this framework cannot... And thus the Vedic accounts often seem absurd or mythological when viewed from the perspective of modern science. At the present time, certain assumptions of modern physics have to be adopted by people in general as the very foundation of their worldview, have been adopted as their foundation of worldview. These assumptions are incompatible with the underlying assumptions of the Vedic worldview, And thus they tend to block people from having free access to Vedic literature. Free access means that, well, you can read a Sankirtan devotee and you have access, you can get the book, but you don't have intellectual access to it. You can't connect with it. It's a different paradigm. In this section, we will try to alleviate this difficulty by discussing the nature of the material energy as described in Vedic literature. Go on. The conceptual advances needed to reconcile the Vedic worldview with modern science may be difficult to make, since they require ideas that radically extend current theories but are not explicitly spelled out in the Vedic text. Srila Prabhupada indicates that this verse, Srila Prabhupada is referring to Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 26, Text 34, which describes the ethereal element as a underlying, a substrate, or in other words, an underlying structure for the production of subtle forms by the mind, and that it is also involved in the circulation of vital air within the body. So Srila Prabhupada indicates that this verse is the potential basis of great scientific research work, and indeed it provides a clear idea of how the subtle mind may interact with gross elements of the body and brain. And that understanding not only helps us to, it takes a lot more orientation, we haven't gotten there yet, but it would help us make sense out of the Puranic descriptions that we read. But not only that, but it also helps us to be more convinced that there is such a thing as soul, and that soul or even mind can interact with gross matter, with the speaker of super soul, making it happen. Because the Vedic descriptions, even in the very Bhagavatam, we may not remember it, but the 3:26:34, for instance, goes into some detail of how it actually works. Scientists still generally adhere to the idea that it is impossible for the brain to interact with a distinct non-physical mind. This, in turn, makes it impossible for them to give credence or to believe in many phenomena that imply the existence of such a mind, even though empirical evidence for these phenomena has existed for many years. Now, the empirical evidence is the paranormal events. And, of course, if you're coming from the modern paradigm, these are just written off as bogus, what are they called? What is it called? Hoaxes, right? Or hocus pocus. And they're just rejected completely. But that's perhaps one of the reasons why both Sariputta Prabhu in his book, one book called Maya, The World as Virtual Reality, and also Jhuta Karma wrote more or less a parallel work called Human Devolution. And in both books, you find several chapters in each book just giving evidence after evidence of paranormal phenomena, though paranormal phenomena implies subtle entities or subtle energies that we can't have readily, because of our limited senses, we don't have ready empirical connection with, but there is empirical evidence. In other words, these paranormal things like apportation, like a big heavy object. Like, what would you think if all of a sudden this bookcase, suppose it was loaded with books, and all of a sudden it got up and started quickly flying across the room and crashed into the wall? Well, your first reaction, if I say this, oh, that can't happen. It doesn't exist. But there are very respectable, normal people in the late 1890s, and early 1900s, and other times in different parts of the world that have sworn to have witnessed this, and it's just a hoax idea. It just doesn't make sense when you consider so many examples and so many things, bending the spoons and all these things which cannot be explained by the laws of physics. as the laws of physics are construed in modern science. Now, quantum physics, that itself is a kind of a bridge, and that's a topic that you read Sataputra's works, you can learn a lot about. So when you say empirical evidence exists, it's referring mostly to these psychic events studied by the parapsychologist, out-of-body experiences, and also the spontaneous remembrance of previous incarnations by small children. Our main point, Sariputta writes, is that it is very difficult for people, including scientists, to seriously contemplate particular ideas about reality unless those ideas fit neatly into familiar and accepted conceptual systems. The current theories of physics have been worked out in great technical detail, and one who lives in the conceptual universe these theories provide may find the Vedic idea of ether, for instance, may seem very crude and unimpressive. In other words, the Vedic description includes the idea of ether, and that may not jive with the going theories of physics. Yet the possibility nonetheless exists that physical theory can be extended by introducing a new conception of the ether that agrees with the Vedic conception and is consistent with experimental observations. And such an extended theory may provide explanations for many phenomena presently considered scientifically impossible. Scientifically impossible doesn't mean that it's ultimately scientifically impossible. It means science as limited by the current paradigms. The alchemical process, Sariputta gives an example of this kind of thing, that in the Vedic view, writings, there wasn't the juxtaposition of the modern outlook on things. So there wasn't a need to explain all these things. It was accepted. It was taken for granted. People accepted, for instance, alchemy. So when Sanatana Goswami, even just a few hundred years ago, wrote about in Hari Bhakti Vilas that he was just using it as an analogy to explain how by initiation ordinary person could be transformed into a brahmana, even if he was lower born. Just as by an alchemical process, bell metal can be changed into gold. Now, he didn't have to explain or rationalize or convince people about the alchemical process. Even, was it Newton? He's a big, big scientist. We don't hear much about it, but they studied alchemy for years and went deeply into it. But that's not accepted at all and doesn't jive with the current understanding of the laws of physics. So the alchemical process is not described, but on the basis of modern science, we might tend to regard such a transformation as impossible, bell metal into gold. Yet the dictionary defines bell metal, now listen to this, the dictionary defines bell metal as an alloy of copper and tin, and if we consult the periodic table of the elements, we find that the atomic numbers of copper and tin add together to give the atomic number of gold. Now, some of you may say, oh, it's just a coincidence. So, this suggests that there just might be something to this example. But if so, it clearly involves an extensive body of practical and theoretical knowledge that is completely unknown to us these days. And then he goes on and describes a chapter called The Position of Krishna. The Vedic conception of space begins with a statement of Krishna's unified nature, rather than with the geometric axioms defining three-dimensional space. Now, this is very important, this use of the term higher dimensional. Let's Sariputta explain it. Prabhu. The term higher dimensional is borrowed from modern mathematics. It does not appear directly in Vedic literature. It is part of an attempt to bridge the conceptual gap between modern thinking and the Vedic worldview. know, and one can criticize, where is Sariputta, why is he talking about higher dimension? We don't find that in Prabhupada's books, higher dimensional. Well, he's saying, quite frankly, what he's trying to do is bridge the two paradigms, modern and the Vedic. So higher dimensional is a good bridge because it's rational and it's comprehensible, or perhaps not able to be experienced by us Kali Yuga creatures, but it's also in modern science, to wit. It does not directly appear in Vedic literature as part of an attempt to bridge the conceptual gap between modern thinking and the Vedic worldview. Naturally, since the traditional followers of Vedic culture have not been confronted with such a gap, they have not been motivated to introduce ideas to bridge it. And that's why we don't find it in the Vedas, because they didn't have this challenge of the latest modern opposing worldview. Since the higher dimensional spaces of mathematics also permit more things to be brought together than the rules of three-dimensional space allow, we have chosen the term higher dimensional to refer to this feature of the Vedic view of reality. A higher dimensional space corresponds to a situation in which access between locations is more restricted than it is for Krishna, but less restricted than it is for beings experiencing three-dimensional space. Now, unfortunately, in Kali Yuga, we're kind of locked in due to our modes of nature that prevail and our sinful activities. In our case, hopefully we're talking about previous, that we're locked into a very limited environment where we only perceive three dimensions. Okay, four with time. The concept of higher dimensional space is closely tied together with the idea of varying levels of sensory development in sentient beings. The ideas about space and its relation to sense perception are implicit in Vedic literature. And gives example of when Lord Brahma went to Dwarka, saw Krishna, and all the Lord Brahmas were present, and some had up to 10 million heads, and so many questions about space come in. How can they all be together? It's like they all experienced Krishna came to their particular universe, and they connected with Dwarka in each of their universes. And only our Lord Brahma saw all the other Lord Brahmas. And also they had up to 10 million or 100 million heads. Now, how can you fit 100 million heads on one? Sariputta points out in a lecture, it looked like some kind of Christmas tree. The ISKCON artists have a very hard time showing even 100 heads on one neck. So how does that work? Well, Banasura, you know, with his 100 bows all at once. And, so it's a different kind of space. It's not that it's just mythology and, you know, this is impossible. This space, according to only 3-4 dimensions, is different. It's limited. It's not the same as what space can do when you're talking about, as in modern quantum physics, they have something called Hilbert space, which is infinite dimensional. What to speak of multidimensional? And that's in modern science. Very highly paid scientists back up that idea. So that example of Lord Brahma raises so many questions, and it gives an example of the higher dimensional nature of Vedic space. Each Brahma accepts our thought that he was alone with Krishna. Each Brahma thought he was just alone with Krishna and Dwarka within his own universe. This illustrates that Krishna has access to all locations at once, and it also shows that by Krishna's grace, different living beings can be given different degrees of spatial access, either permanently or temporarily. Now, some of you may be wondering, what does this have to do with Sudakshina? Well, it's going in that direction. It's in the more general sense of mystic power, like Prapti City and the ability to jump in the Ganges and immediately surface in a very distant location, which is, I believe, still going on in some places in India. And because, although we're not Krishna, but it's not that everybody is as limited as we are. Forgive me if some of you have mystic powers and you're not limited like that. But as we heard earlier, we never become as omnipresent as Krishna, but we can become relatively spread out. We can have more access to more locations at once. And in case I don't have time to get to it, I should mention that Sariputta will quote two verses from Brahma Sangita, Angani Yasya Saglendriya Vrittimanti, and a kopya soda chahitam jagananda kotim yat chaktirasti jagananda chayai dantaha andantarasta paramanu chayantarastam govinda manipurisham samahata. To really emphasize the fundamentally different and much more expanded and extended physics, you can call it. Physics goes beyond gross material energies. It can accommodate very nicely subtle energies, and not only that, but it accommodates not only Krishnas, but other living entities who have mystic powers, their respective greater or lesser access to many locations at the same time, like Prapti City. It's not like the mystic is like the Elastic Man. There used to be a comic book like that. And he extends his hand and it stretches all the way to the moon or all the way to Kabul in Afghanistan and picks up a pomegranate, yeah, or whatever. Or that the yogi can touch the moon with his finger or something. It's not that the arm is stretching. It's that they have access, immediate access, to what in three-dimensional space is very remote locations. Remember, Krishna is completely present in every atom, in every universe. And within Krishna, all the universes are present. That means that in the ultimate issue, all the universes are present in every single atom. It's an irrefutable logic, unless you want to say that logic doesn't apply in this case. If all the universes are in Krishna and Krishna is in every atom, it's not that Krishna takes out the universes from within him. The universes, in other words, everything is everywhere. Everything is present everywhere, but not if our experience is only in three-dimensional space. Therefore, higher dimensional reality is a key feature to this bridge between the Vedic and the modern conceptions. Each Brahma accepts authority was absolute. Krishna has access to all locations at once, and it also shows that different living beings can have relatively greater access also. Krishna can reveal all locations through his all-encompassing form. In other words, in the universal form chapter in Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna saw all locations at once. We can sum up the idea of dimensionality of space by saying that the greater the degree of access between locations, the higher the dimensionality of the space. I guess it works vice versa also. In other words, higher dimensional reality includes greater access of different locations. He perceives space, since Krishna has simultaneous access to all locations, he perceives space at the highest level of dimensionality. If there anyone has infinite dimensionality, it's Krishna. Different living beings will perceive space at different levels of dimensionality, and thus they will have access to different sets of locations or locus. The three-dimensional bonding of carbon and other atoms is made possible by the higher dimensional interactions within the atoms. Thus, I'm kind of skipping ahead, getting into the context of quantum physics. Thus, although the idea of higher dimensional realms may seem to be an extreme departure from accepted scientific thinking, it is possible to interpret modern physics as laying the groundwork for an idea. I suppose I should have read the example of that. The quantum mechanical atom cannot be represented in three-dimensional space. In fact, to represent something as commonplace as an atom of carbon, quantum mechanics makes use of a kind of infinite dimensional space called Hilbert space, as I mentioned earlier. So Sariputta Prabhu, oh, by the way, time's up. So this is like protocol. All the hands are jumping up. Wow, we can go on till 11 o'clock this morning. Sometimes done, I like to do this, is if somebody needs to go or wants to go, you can go. And there's no offense. You can offer your respects and leave quietly. And I'm not going to say good riddance. Sorry, I don't want to be offensive. Not at all. You may have some very important thing to do. Even taking prasadam is pretty important. If others would like to hang in for a while, I was told that I have till 9 o'clock, but we could even go a little beyond that if there are questions. I think there'll be a few. Then you're welcome to stay, and I'm at your service. Let me just read a little more here. So that's in other words, in quantum physics, Sariputta Prabhu wrote a book, one of his first books. I gave it to my father, and I hope he read it at some point in his life, called Mechanistic and Non-Mechanistic Science. So quantum mechanics is actually kind of like extending to a certain extent beyond what you might call mechanistic science. It does get more subtle, it includes consciousness in fact. All right, so the next section is mystic cities, and Prapti cities there I already described. And Sariputta Prabhu makes a brilliant reference to verses in the 11th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam that show that the cities are indeed obtained by partial realization of Krishna's inherent potencies. I'll just give two examples. Anima, becoming smaller than the smallest. Quote, this is 11th canto, 15th chapter, text 10 through 13. One who worships me, Krishna, in my atomic form, pervading all subtle elements, Bhuta, Sukshma, and Tanmatra, fixing his mind on that alone, obtains the mystic perfection of anima, becoming smaller than the smallest. Mahima, becoming greater than the greatest. One who absorbs his mind in the particular form of the Mahatattva and thus meditates on me as the supreme soul of the total material existence achieves the mystic perfection called Mahima. Then Lagima, and it goes on like that, goes through all the mystic cities and describes it's a different style or a meditating on a different aspect of Krishna. Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati states that those who pursue such perfections without fixing the mind on Supreme Lord Krishna acquire a gross and inferior reflection of each mystic potency. Which is interesting, because now we finally get to Sudakshi. And he was not, he was in one sense fixing his mind on Krishna, but in not according to the prescriptions, and not favorably. So he got so inferior that it was like a boomerang and came back and killed him. There's the next section here called the activities of demigods, yogis, and rishis. I'll just read a little bit more and then have some questions. Our thesis is that this ability to appear and disappear as one of the mystic cities is the demigods and even demons, they have the ability to appear and disappear and to appear in different form. What is that called? Shape changing, right? And again, the Western or modern impulse will write it off as mythology, but there is a rational way of understanding this. Our thesis is that its ability, for instance, to appear and disappear is not just a matter of mystical power, and that we don't say anything else about it. Rather, it demonstrates an important feature of the physical world in which we live, This world contains many manifestations that are not accessible to us with our ordinary, you can say, Kali Yuga senses, but that are accessible to more highly developed beings, such as the demigods. There is a hierarchy of dimensional levels within the universe, and beings on one particular level can operate within a larger continuum than beings on lower levels. The spiritual realm of Vaikuntha and Goloka Vrindavan is on a still higher level. Thus, Brahma, the topmost demigod within the material universe, became completely bewildered when Krishna revealed the spiritual world to him. We suggest that this process of travel, getting back to going through the Ganges River and going from one place to another, between locations involves higher dimensional connections between locations. Remember, we were pointing out that higher dimensional realization, then everything is much more connected. Up to the, well, we quoted that Bhagavatam about how Krishna is everywhere. And that the river serves as a kind of guiding beacon to direct such higher dimensional transport. In the case of the Ganges, the course of the river from the higher planets down to the earth must also be higher dimensional. Many remarkable events that are said to have taken place on earth in the remote past involve, now the last point I want to make is, well, too late, okay. I won't make any more points now. If someone wants to contribute something, Steve D. Muni Prabhu had his hand up first. Okay, we'll get to you in a moment. You did? Okay. Keshava, Krishna Keshava.
Hare Krishna. Hariparayan Prabhu, who is a scientist and a professor at the University of Florida.
Who's here in Alachua?
He lives in Alachua.
Yeah.
So he has sent by text a few points, actually, and question and also observation. He says, as the Bhagavatam doesn't say that reality is higher dimensional, how can we be sure that Sadaputta Prabhu's explanations of the Bhagavatam reality in terms of modern scientific ideas are correct? How is it in terms of modern scientific ideas are correct?
Well, Sadaputta is not claiming to be explaining the Bhagavatam. What he's trying to do is to help us bridge the Bhagavatam understanding with modern scientific understanding. And he's choosing a higher dimensional reality because it's consistent. It's a different term that's not used in the Bhagavatam, and if you remember, we explained why it's not used in the Bhagavatam, because the Bhagavatam had no need to make that bridge because the other side didn't exist. In other words, the modern perspective. So he's not claiming to this is a bridge between the Bhagavatam and the modern perspective. And he does point out that it is a bridge because higher dimensional reality is accepted in quantum mechanics, quantum physics. And then at the same time, it's consistent conceptually with what we hear in the Bhagavatam. It kind of gives us a handle to understand. If you don't make that word, I'm sure we could find in the Bhagavatam Sanskrit terminology that would be quite equivalent to a higher dimension. We'll get to you.
Thank you.
A little more.
Okay, it continues.
What?
So you can call it anything, but it's an English word, higher dimensional reality, and it suggests phenomena that isn't constricted by our negotiating length.
Right. I think what you're saying, what I said, are pretty much.
Yeah. No. I'm supporting.
Okay. Now let Krishna Keshava continue his. He's giving us some input from a scientist.
Okay. More broadly speaking. Is science, its terminology, and its evidence a valid hermeneutics to interpret the Bhagavatam? For example, Sariputta Prabhu explains Vedic cosmology as being consistent with modern cosmology using modern scientific methodology. As science is speculative and constantly changing, how reliable our discussions of the Bhagavatam in a modern scientific context. Should I read more?
Well, I just responding to that, if they're not valid, in other words, we end up having to write off everything in modern science, and then we become like sort of like completely disoriented. We can't write off everything. Sariputta, we were hearing, he acknowledges and he recognizes that within that scope, and now even extending into quantum physics, modern science has come up with some things that do have validity up within up to a certain context. If we just say, well, it's all Maya and it's nothing, then we kind of disconnect ourselves with everything about the world of our experience and going in a jet plane, and so many things that we do, we become like a little schizoid. We have two different worlds. So I think it's valuable, and also to help to give us more faith and conviction. Then it's I find it myself redeeming, helpful, and even spiritually life-saving to be able to have this connection. Yes, when one becomes very, very, very advanced in spiritual life, one can jettison or completely toss out even this process of jnana, this process of knowledge, this process of rational understanding and logic. But I'm not there yet. I find it very helpful to have the support of some logical and scientific explanation. And when Sariputta Prabhu passed away, of course, he was here in Alachua, and when he passed away, all the leaders in the society were eulogizing him as the one word repeated in their eulogies, genius. I mean, they recognized he was a genius. And he wasn't an evil genius. He wasn't a genius, just a materialist. He was a genius, spiritual genius, because he was doing this unprecedented work. And the more I read his writings and hear his lectures, I just am so, personally, I'm very impressed. Now, what is the name, Haripad? Hariparayanpu may not agree with me, and I certainly respect, I hope we agree to disagree, but my take on Sariputta is first class.
There is a little more.
You have a little more, go ahead.
How can a speculative scientific method bridge with absolute reality? Absolute reality is beyond speculation. It is apurusheya. Why should it be subject to speculation? Why do we need to reconcile the Vedic view with the scientific view when the scientific view is limited? What if the proposed reconciliation is wrong? The higher dimensional space is speculation and sounds like mythology too. It sounds like a cop-out, a compromise. Hilbert space is not mythology. It is a well-defined space with well-defined properties. The soul cannot be measured with any modern instrument, with any physical method. Such connections invite scrutiny by scientists, and our responses are hand-waving and unprovable. Science must be kept outside, commenting on the Bhagavatam.
Yeah, well, theologically, from a theological point of view, that leads us towards a God of the gaps. I don't have time to explain that, but some of you may catch the hint. But he was asking, how can we reconcile, because Krishna is the absolute truth. If the absolute truth is the absolute truth, then it also includes relative truth. In other words, the absolute truth includes everything, including including modern science. In other words, it's not that modern science is not ultimately contained within the omniscient Supreme Personality of Godhead. Sita D was anxious to say something. Prabhu.
One thing, you know, Hari Prana, we all know him. He's one of our people here. But one thing is that he does bring up this point is like when we give a Bhagavatam class and we start referencing things like this Hilbert's law or whatever the heck it is, you know, we have this very like headline layman's version of what these scientists are talking about. We may see certain parallels between our very superficial understanding of what they're talking about and make a connection, and that could be very useful for just popular discussion. But a scientist still listening to our analysis of Hilbert's law or something, and it's like, you know, kindergartners reading cartoons.
All right, then maybe that's why Hari Parayana had some misgivings. But we are talking about our own sangha, and we are trying to enliven one another.
So that's the eternal benefit. But I'm just saying to be aware.
The fact that scientists may not be able to digest it or relate to it doesn't necessarily mean it's wrong either.
No. Okay. Well, it's who knows what's right.
Unless you're giving them absolute power of attorney.
Right. So we're talking two different things here. One is we're talking about, and this is what Hari Parayana I think also brought up. We're talking about essential Siddhantic principles, which is where we have an authority, and then we're finding references in science and in the news and sort of illustrating these Siddhantic principles. So we may not be so expert at what's happening in the news or what's happening in science, but what we are expert on is these Siddhantic principles, just so that we're aware. Sometimes we use our illustrations.
We don't want to go beyond our jurisdiction, but the point is, the reason I feel so comfortable studying and reading and hearing from Sariputta Prabhu is because he's qualified.
All right, and then here's something, this is what I really want to get out here.
He's qualified in both realms.
Well, he's very qualified.
Spiritually and also scientifically.
Yeah, I'm not here to discourage that sentiment. One thing that he did write, this is in 2004, and I wonder how you would feel this reconciles with some of the...
Who are you quoting? Sariputta Prabhu?
Sariputta Prabhu. Okay. He wrote this in 2004. In summary, by bringing together modern scientific ideas and Vedic literature, many interesting ideas arise. It is widely believed that there is a fundamental conflict between science and religion, and that this can be reconciled only by either drastically editing religion to agree with science, or drastically doing violence to science in order to bring it into line with religion. However, science and religion can cross-fertilize one another and give rise to possible fruitful ideas that might not have been thought of from the standpoint of science or religion taken separately.
I have a book in my library in Trinidad called The History of Science and Religion. And the stereotype that they're always in conflict is not quite correct. In history, there's been a lot of very capable scientists in religious communities and vice versa. All right, I wouldn't be complete without Trivikram.
Interesting. Srila Prabhupada, he had a short circuit for his scientists.
Short shrift.
And the scientific field, because all their findings are based on sense perception. And because of that, that limits the knowledge that's in the Vedic realm. You see, their findings is limited to sense perception, and so
It limits their access to the Vedic realm.
Yeah. But what's good about them, for example...
Before you go, Pushkar, did you want to contribute something to this discussion? Did you have something to say?
For example, the age, right? The age of the universe. They come pretty close, you know, and those are things that back us up. Because, for example, in Christianity, you find that they have the age of the universe as about 5,000 years or 10,000 years, the most, you see? Whereas we have it as 4,320,000. Science has it something pretty close to that. So there's a lot of connections there. But
but one can argue that those connections are just incidental or something. What's the main point you're getting at?
Yeah, but anyhow, I'm showing that is a positive step between science and religion, because if some of the research could find the connections between our concept and their findings, then that's...
Yeah, for me, the most positive step is Prabhupada's encouragement. We even read, this is an opportunity for great scientific research specifically understanding the relationship between the subtle and gross. And also Prabhupada used the word scientific. Was he justified to use the word? I believe he was. There's a science, a more subtle science. There's a science of the soul. There's a science of God. There's a right to use that word. Now, Stita Di Muni, maybe some alarms are going off. No, okay, good. But I think we can... Right, of course. Yeah. It's not the only one. Oh, okay. Thank you all very much. Jagat Guru, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Granth Raj Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. If I may, Sariputta Prabhu ki jai. Adi Guru.